Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act has a sunset of September 1st, 2006. And what this memorial does, with, especially with the Dash 2 amendments, it urges Congress to reestablish this for another 10 years. If Congress fails to do that, the counties and the schools in Oregon will lose more than $500 million a biennium. For some of the counties, it will mean they will come up and give the keys to the governor, and I'm not being overly dramatic when I say that. It's critically important. The leadership of this legislature has already written a letter to our delegation, the president, the speaker, and the four caucus leaders some time ago, and this memorial is simply asking the rest of the legislature to also lend their voices to our delegation, so they'll have a piece of paper to go around and say, when they're talking to other members of Congress, this is critically important to our local governments in Oregon, and it has to happen. We are very encouraged by what we hear from Washington, D.C. This is just another very important arrow in the quiver for our congressional delegation. I would urge you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, which were, frankly, a bit of an oversight by the drafters. You would be the first to admit that, and then send the memorial to the floor of the DuPass.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett, any questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you. Representative Dave Hunt is here to testify. Thank you, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to be back before this committee instead of on that side. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I am happy to be here also representing Representative Jeff Merkley today. He, as you know, as Mr. Barrows mentioned, is one of the four chief sponsors of this bill. It really is very much bipartisan, bicameral support for this. Like my colleague, Representative Sumner, I also come from one of the ONC counties, and it's critically dependent on, as was said, our counties and schools are critically dependent on this money. If Congress does not pass this, it will blow such a big hole in our state budget and local budgets that it will make what we're going to deal with this session look like we're actually having fun. This really is an issue of providing a safety net. It's not a welfare program for our states. These counties and school districts have been dramatically hurt by the drop off in these revenues, and this really does just begin to keep them not even whole, but begin to plug at least some of the holes that they have experienced. If this is not reauthorized and extended in 2006, the revenue from these lands would drop by 95%. So it's huge drops. It's a great opportunity for us to come together from all parts of our state and across party lines and support something that will really keep these districts whole, keep our counties relatively whole, and provide some resources that they can continue to function and not have to turn to us if this does not pass. As I look at all the issues facing the federal budget, and as we see the president's budget in about 10 days, we're going to see huge shortfalls in a lot of programs because of shortfalls in federal revenues. This is one, I think, where we need to stand up in that context and say this is a priority for Oregon, and we're going to join together in supporting that. So on behalf of both Representative Merkley and myself, I'm happy to be here and encourage you to wholeheartedly support this.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Hunt? Well, great. Thank you very much. There was the only two people who signed up. I'll close the public hearing. And I'll open the workshop. And I'll take a motion. Senator Bradley?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the House Joint Memorial 1-2 amendments dated January 26th.
Representative Burley has moved to adopt the House Joint Memorial 2 amendments dated January 26th. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
And not that we've had, I mean, there seems to be an awful lot of interest in this room, but it's great that it looks like everybody's supporting it and not willing to belabor how important this is to the state, because I think we all agree with you that it is. That's why there probably be no questions, really, or weren't any questions from the committee. We all know how important it is, and I'm really happy to be supporting this.
Thank you. Any other comments? There's no further discussion. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered, the amendments are adopted. Representative Burley?
Madam Chair, I move the House Joint Memorial 1 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Burley has moved House Joint Memorial 1 as amended to the floor with an adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any comments?
I think that it's important for people to understand that, you know, when federal government makes policy at times, those policies have direct impacts on local governments. And they have direct impacts on all of our lives. And those of us that live in those rural areas watch the impact of forest management things that the federal government does. And they own a lot of our land in this state. And I believe that there's an obligation on their part to continue to help what I believed was a federal goodwill towards all of us, that they understood that there are costs that are attributed with their the regulations that they pass, and those costs need to be borne by the federal government and the regulations they make. And this is just one more continuation of the goodwill that should be there for those of us that have counties with lots of timber that is not being harvested right now, and therefore we need to keep the local governments going, and it's just essential.
Thank you. Any other comments? I think those are all great comments. I think that just shows how important this issue is to everyone. So I thank you for bringing it forward. We're pleased to do our. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byers?
Aye.
Representative Bowles?
Excused.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Pass?
Aye.
Representative Rowland?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Burley, would you like to carry this?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. And Representative Burley will be the carrier. Thank you very much. To close the work. The House Committee will move. Well, I'm glad, too, to see all the people in the room. We're going to have an informational hearing only. And I will open the informational hearing. And we're going to have a briefing just so this committee gets up to speed on the basically the difference and where we're going on the biofuel and biodiesels and just good information. So we've asked several people to come forward and give us an idea. And committee, feel free to ask any questions as we go along. Or I think we're going to see this issue many times this session. But just today is going to be short and sweet and good information, I hope. Thank you. So I'll call David Van Hoff from the Governor's Office and Glenn Munn. Montgomery from the Oregon Economic and Community Development. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. Thank you for having us come in and talk a little bit about biofuels. I'm Dave Vantoff from the Governor's Office and Glenn Montgomery from the Economic Development Office. And we were just going to very briefly kind of kick this off and then let some of the experts come up and provide more detailed information about biofuels. But and we'd be very interested in any comments or questions. So we'll keep our presentation short, and if there's anything you want to hear from us, we're happy to fill it in. But basically, I just wanted to have a chance to talk to the committee and express the governor's great interest in biofuels and his belief that we have a really important window this session and over the next 2 years to try and generate biofuels industry in Oregon. There's been kind of a critical mass of interest growing around the state, around the biofuels issue, and one of the great things about it is we're seeing it really cross all sorts of sectors. It's got strong support in the environmental community, strong support in the agricultural community. The business community is strongly supportive, and you'll hear from some folks from the development side later today about real proposals to move forward in Oregon with real jobs and real development of the industry. And part of the reason I think that there's such wide support for it is because it's going to benefit the entire state. There's real opportunity, not just in urban parts of the state, but in rural parts of the state, and it creates, I think, excellent synergies for focusing our economic development efforts. And Glenn will touch more on that as we continue on. The governor has, over the past year, been engaged in several initiatives in which biofuels has been an integral piece of the discussion, the puzzle. One is the Renewable Energy Action Plan work that he asked the Department of Energy to coordinate with stakeholders from around the state and other state agencies. And that plan is currently in draft form. It's very detailed. It's had much public input from across the state, and it ranges across the renewable energy sectors, and biofuels being one of the important pieces of it. And it recommends that we take some aggressive actions to try and stimulate biofuels development in the state. In addition, the governor's been very invested in global warming discussions, both at the West Coast level and in the state of Oregon. He has an advisory group that had been meeting for a year this past year, and they've developed a detailed range of recommendations on what the state could do to try and address carbon emissions and how to reduce carbon emissions. And biofuels is an integral part of that discussion as well, as is renewable energy. So there's really a focus on biofuels coming from a lot of different areas, and it's coming to a head, and we're hoping that this session, as you mentioned, Chair, that there's likely to be a lot of interest with some legislative bills around biofuels as well coming out. Just a couple other things I wanted to touch on in terms of stakeholder involvement, which is pretty exciting. There's growing, I think, organization of groups to try and promote biofuels and renewable energy. I was just in Bend for the kickoff of a BASE, what they're calling a BASE launch, which is a 9-county effort in Central Oregon to target renewable energy development as one of the key economic opportunities for Central Oregon, and biofuels again being one of the pieces that they're working on. The governor's office also, with the Departments of Agriculture and Energy and a group called Climate Solutions, and the Oregon Farm Bureau had been sponsoring outreach efforts with the state's farmers and agricultural associations over the past several months. And that's including presentations to the Oregon Farm Bureau, Wheat Growers League, Seed Growers League, Oregon Grange, Oregon Association of Counties, and the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And those discussions, the effort was to just try and make educate and get a sense of where those groups were at in understanding the opportunities that were presented with biofuels and renewable energy. And there was very good feedback and interest among those groups as well, and that was a very encouraging sign. As you see with the group here in the room, there's a lot of folks that heard about this and want to show that this is an issue that is coming forward and hopefully will be addressed by the legislature this session. So I'm going to stop with that unless there's questions in terms of the governor's office, and hand it over to Glenn to talk more specifically about the economic development piece.
That's great. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As David mentioned, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Sustainable Business Liaison for Economic and Community Development. I just want to share briefly with you some of the economic benefits that we see, along with environmental benefits. And rather than stun you with many facts and figures today, I will give you just some brief data, and we can dig as deep as you wish. But in general, what we see in this particular industry is a growing trend in demand for bio-based fuels. And for Oregon in particular, we have an opportunity in the agricultural sector to diversify our crop rotations, to maximize the value of the yields that we have. And even beyond biofuels, there is an opportunity to engage in other types of industries such as bioceuticals, which has an even higher value add, which is where we'd really like to be focusing our attention, is on the value added sectors rather than the commodity based sectors, to be able to give farmers more control over what they grow and how much they get for their crops. So that I see as a huge opportunity. we also have an opportunity from a sustainability standpoint to benefit the natural resources in our environment through the use of biofuels. I'm sure you're aware that they are more benign than fossil fuels, and we can not only free ourselves up from our dependency on fossil fuels, which are imported into this country, but to be looking at an opportunity to find locally grown fuels that can not only benefit Oregon, but can be exported to other parts of the country. And just to give you an example, on the West Coast, with respect to ethanol, it's estimated that there is a demand of about 3 billion gallons. And yet, on the West Coast, we only produce about 10 million gallons of ethanol. So there's a huge opportunity there for us to close that gap. The same thing would be true for biodiesel. There is a law that will be enacted that requires ultra-low sulfur diesel. You may be familiar with the term. And the problem with that is that it is more abrasive on the engine and it needs a lubricity agent. And biodiesel can be that lubricity agent. And even a 2% blend of biodiesel with regular petroleum diesel can increase demand by 110 million gallons in Oregon. That alone, in the West Coast. We have no biodiesel production facilities here in the West Coast. So, again, you're looking at a huge opportunity for us to invest in production facilities here. There was a recent study done in 2002. And to give you an example of what economic impacts may occur by having a 40 million gallon ethanol plant, it would provide a one-time boost of approximately $140 million in terms of construction costs and labor, expand the local economic base by about $110 million each year through direct spending of $56 million, create 41 full-time jobs and approximately 694 jobs throughout the supplier chain, indirect jobs, if you will. Increase annual household incomes for the community by roughly $20 million, and thereby increasing state income and local property and business tax receipts. So that's just an example of a 40 million gallon plant for ethanol. The same could be said for biodiesel as well. So I'm going to stop with facts there, but I hope that I've impressed upon you some of the opportunities that we have here. And as David mentioned, there's a diverse set of stakeholders that are collaborating and are behind these initiatives. So the public support is there, and I believe that we are at the cusp of some wonderful trends that we can take advantage of in the very near term. So I'm open to any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Montgomery? None.
Well, thank you.
Wow.
Thanks, Chair Smith. We'd be happy to come back if there's any further hearings or issues to cover, and look forward to hearing the rest of the presentations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure, we will continue. We have next Dr. David Hackelman, Dr. Tom Chastain, and Dr. Jen, I can't even say that, Ayoung. Did I say that right? Oregon State University wanted to come up together? Did I say that right?
That's fine.
Okay, it's fine. She's a great
It's close.
Close.
Okay. We have a name like Smith.
That's what I had wished for.
Yeah, I haven't even asked people, haven't asked me how to spell it. You've got to be kidding me. Welcome.
Well, welcome. I'm not too accustomed to this, Chair Smith, so I apologize. Welcome, and thank you for allowing us to attend, members of the committee. We're going to go through a presentation, and the three of us are talking, and I don't know my entire time available, so I'm going to ask these people to remind me when I talk too long, because we want everybody to have a chance.
Believe me, that's my job.
Okay. I was going to mention right now, before I start, that we have actually some members of the Biodiesel Initiative from Oregon State University here, and if they could stand, please, I'd sure appreciate it.
You need to give your name for the record.
My name is David Hackelman, and we have, go ahead.
Tom Chastain, Oregon State University.
Okay.
John Ayoung, Oregon State University.
Thank you.
Okay, and we're
people standing.
Are you guys standing?
They were.
They were, okay.
Until I interrupted.
They actually drove here in a biodiesel-powered vehicle that's outside right now, and if you have time after this session, you're welcome to come out and see it. It's parked right out front of the Capitol, thanks to the assistance of your committee.
Thank you.
One is a former student of mine. Oh.
Yeah, so you recognize each other. I hope
well,
it was
welcome.
A good thing.
Good thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so in this briefing, we're going to give you an idea about biodiesel. I'm going to be a bit quick. There's handouts. If you want more information later on, you're welcome to chat with us.
Thank you.
And this our agenda. We're aiming at talking about an overall picture of energy demand, so you're going to see a bit more of the data that the previous speakers alluded to, probably in more detail than you ever want to see. Okay? And we'll talk about biodiesel and ethanol and actions and progress at Oregon State University. First of all, the outlook of energy in the United States of America. I thought I'd put this up just to give you an idea. If you look at this graph, you'll notice that the one called transportation, which is the lime green color on here, you'll notice how it's growing. It's the fastest growing segment. Okay, now the units, a quadrillion BTUs is a huge unit, okay, and realize that that's the entire United States. But you can see that that's the one that's growing the most. So our biggest focus is we have to find a way to have enough energy for transportation. That's the biggest deal within the United States and the world. Okay, from that, here is Oregon. In Oregon, we're using about 800 million gallons of diesel a year. You'll notice the other one on this graph is gasoline. I'm going to really focus a bit on diesel right now, and that's what you see here. And it's more or less 800 million gallons. Thanks very much to Phil Carver of the Oregon Department of Energy for giving us this information. Today we're focusing on biodiesel and ethanol, and you notice I'm going quick because this is... some people want to know what biodiesel is. Basically, biodiesel functions like diesel. It is not exactly the same as the stuff that they call diesel from the petroleum industry. It's made from vegetable oils, seed oils, and alcohol. You take those two, you put them together, and with a chemical reaction, you make biodiesel. You can use recycled cooking oil. Okay, that's a possible source. It is not petroleum. There's a lot of manufacturing cost leeway because right now it's what you'd call an emerging market. The current price, if you want to buy it, is around $3.25 a gallon. Okay. And by the way, feel free to stop me at any time. Here is not as much how it's made, but the entire system, but it is how it's made. In the case of petroleum diesel, you go out and find it. Okay. And if you notice this... it takes about the cycle between the time that the little animals die and create petroleum. It takes about 10 million years for that cycle to take place between the time when we mine it. Unfortunately, we're drawing petroleum diesel out of the earth faster than it's being created. So sooner or later, we're going to run out, okay, unless the earth is infinitely vast. And I don't think it is. Last time I checked, it actually is a globe. Okay. On the right is the biodiesel system, and here's where we want to mention something. You notice the jobs in green. Every action that is in green would be jobs in Oregon. Okay? In the case of the petroleum diesel, you can see that we have a few. We have stations, and we put stuff in our vehicles. In the case of biodiesel, we can do everything. It's a one-year cycle from the time you grow the seed. You can grow the seed the next year and make more biodiesel. I'm going to mention this briefly, but basically what this is the sustainable cycle of biodiesel. And in it, all these little boxes show that academics and people at Oregon State University have been thinking very much about how you can use everything that you have in the biodiesel system to our benefit. That's all the way from the feedstock, starting off with the oil seed, making things, collecting it, crushing it, all the way down to the fact that at the bottom, you notice in the bottom left, it says something like purified to USP grade on glycerin. That's where the gentlemen were talking about the biopharmaceuticals, so things like that. They come right out of this system. It actually turns out that there's an amazing number of things that you have in there, and conveniently, in the upper right, you see where it says use industrial knowledge and low-cost equipment. Oregon has a lead in that area. We're quite good at creating things out of very little cost to manufacture, and I'm sure that the folks are going to tell you a little bit about that later in the next group. Okay. Other useful products than the biodiesel. You can get glycerin, like I mentioned. It's got a higher value than the biodiesel by far, okay, if it's USP grade. You can also make things like soap. There's something called acrolein that comes out of the glycerin system, and that actually makes polymers. You've probably seen some of those. One of them is the polymer that's used in absorbing materials like baby wipes and things like that, okay. You can take the mash, ferment it into alcohol. You can also use it as a cattle feed, and it does not have mad cow disease because it's a vegetable product. Delightful, isn't it? There's a hydrogen source. Research at OSU has demonstrated that you can get the hydrogen out of the biodiesel system, and you can head for the hydrogen technology in the future. This is through things like the ANAMI program that you guys have been so gracious to help support. Lubricity additive, you heard about that already. And basically, there's no waste. That's pretty nice. Okay, implications for Oregon. I now pass the baton off to my gentleman friend from agriculture and my lady friend from agriculture.
Okay, so what are the implications for Oregon and Oregon agriculture? We have a couple of major crops that I want to talk about today and a model biodiesel system oilseed crop that Dr. Hackelman mentioned, in this case canola for biodiesel. Here in the Willamette Valley we have about 500,000 acres of grass seed crops grown out of nearly a million arable acres in this valley. Statewide we have another 900,000 acres of wheat out of a total of 4 million arable acres statewide. Both grass seed crops and wheat rank among the top agricultural commodities in the state, but both are limited by the need for economic rotations that could aid in pest control and could also diversify economic enterprises for the producers. If we could grow a crop such as canola for biodiesel, this could be this valuable rotation crop for the producers. Now, canola-based biodiesel is very similar to petroleum-based biodiesel, but as has been mentioned, it has lower emissions. Grown on 100,000 acres, for instance, here in the Willamette Valley, with a conservative yield of about 2,400 pounds per acre, we could produce 63 million gallons of B20-grade biodiesel each year. On the other hand, if we could add another 100,000 acres in the central and eastern parts of the state, we could up that total to 125 million gallons per year. Those are conservative estimates at this point. Why canola? It's a high-yield crop. It produces a higher yield than any other oil seed crop that we can grow here in the Pacific Northwest. It can be grown at a very low cost. The Oregon farmers have experience with biodiesel. It requires no special equipment. We have adapted varieties already in the region, and they're not genetically engineered varieties as well. The meal after oil extraction is a valuable source of livestock feed because of its high protein nature. Growers can expect about 1,500 pounds per acre as a result of this, with values for the meal exceeding $200 per ton with current prices. So production of canola for biodiesel would not only diversify Oregon's crop production enterprises, but it could also produce locally grown renewable fuels and a protein-rich animal feed. So how can we meet this demand with our current agricultural capacities? As Dr. Hackelman has mentioned, we currently consume about 800 million gallons of diesel annually. So if we were to apply that to 100% grade biodiesel, we would need 8 million acres of farmland to produce at 100 gallons per acre of oil from an oilseed crop. This is more acres than we currently have. On the other hand, we can readily, with the 200,000 acres I've mentioned, we can readily supply the state's needs at reasonable levels of oil production between 100 and 200 gallons per acre. We can reasonably supply the needs for the B5 and the B2 grade as currently proposed. With some improvements in technology, management practices, and introduction of new varieties, we could readily increase that as well. There still is a need for processing and other kinds of management facilities, though, to make this happen in Oregon.
Okay. So we've given you a pretty good idea in terms of our near-term opportunities in terms of biodiesel. What I'd like to do is take a minute to talk about one of the other biofuels, ethanol, that might also present us opportunities for Oregon's economic development. Right now, ethanol in Oregon, the use is about 4% of Oregon's gasoline supply. But most of, in fact, all of this comes from the Midwest. None of it is produced here in the Northwest. So as part of the MTBE, which is the additive in their gasoline right now to help the pinging and improve the operation of gasoline, they're talking about phasing that out, although there is some discussion in the national level about how this might constrain some of the energy bills that are coming out. But if they do phase it out, and they are planning to work on that, ethanol is definitely a product that would substitute for that and produce a better gasoline and usage for the cars. Ethanol is a great opportunity for Oregon. Right now, we don't have as much of a lead in terms of the technology or the capability of producing it. It requires a little bit more in terms of R&D and manufacturing than the biodiesel because of the structure of the straw and the plants that it would come out of. We need to make it possible for us to retrieve the starches and sugars that are in these plants to get them out and then create the ethanol. So some of the constraints is working in that research area and also in terms of plants. You can turn. So in terms of opportunities for Oregon, this, if we used all of the available acreages taken away from biodiesel, we could produce 260 million gallons of ethanol, which I believe would be within the range of what they were talking about producing for the demand that might be expected for the West Coast. But this would preclude using acreages for anything else. So obviously we have to sit down and decide things, how much of it should be for commodities, how much for these value-added products, and which products we would want to work on. So, back to David.
Okay. So now, of course, Jan, on the first part of that slide, you'll notice that the first part was straw, which is one example of a waste product that we're not using effectively, and we can easily make that in, well, it's not easy, but we can make it into ethanol. It takes effort, and people know how to do that. Okay, now, at OSU, we're doing a lot of stuff right now. One thing I would like to mention is that we have an active biodiesel initiative throughout campus. You'll notice you're seeing people from the Agriculture College and the Engineering College at the same time at the same table right now. All over the campus, we have 50 students that are actively involved in this right now and several, many, many faculty members. We have some synthesis research on processes that do not utilize a catalyst. That's really beneficial because once we take this catalyst, which is a strong base, out of the biodiesel synthesis, and we're using micro and nanotechnology thanks to the Anami work, we now have a material which is even better because it does not have the contamination and it becomes pharmaceutical grade instantaneously, separates nicely. In the College of Agricultural Sciences, did you want to talk about that, or should I go on with it?
You can go ahead.
Okay, first of all, there's some biodiesel-specific seed research for Oregon. We're trying to find ways to make it so that if we put out seeds like this, they're not going to create a problem for some other crops, and we're working on it pretty effectively. By the way, some of these seeds actually act as a natural herbicide and reduce the need for spraying herbicides on your land between crops. So if you use it as a rotation crop, it saves the farmer money. That's kind of a nice thing for farmers. They like to save money. Okay, the lignocellulose conversion discussion up here, you notice that the word timber is in there. We haven't even talked about the timber residues that we could use and make into alcohols. Those are also available, and there's work with the USDA on processes to do that. And there's some research on the biofuel bioproducts and the economics. We're just scratching the surface on examining the economics. But you saw on the earlier slide where all of those different jobs. So there's an interesting economic web that we can weave with this.
One other opportunity that we have is the SunGrind Initiative, which is a federal supported program. And right now there's five networks in the regions. Oregon State University is the base for the Western region, so that's for the nine Western states. And our opportunities are in the areas of timber and waste products from agriculture, as well as direct energy crops and pharmaceutical opportunities. So the mission, though, is to enhance the energy security by developing bio-based fuels and other products, diversifying rural communities through placing these bio-based industries within the, in those communities, and then also providing diversifying agriculture and forestry through renewable energy crops and bio-based products. So the Sun Grant initiative is to produce grants for research and education to develop these renewable energy and bioproducts, and the source of funds come from various federal agencies such as Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, also in transportation, and the highway bill, I believe, has a line item which would produce funds for these five regional centers. One of the things that we are looking at in particular is the economic portions of developing this industry. The federal government has done a lot of work at that national level, but in terms of what crops and what are the obstacles in the state levels and regional levels, those things really need to get done, and we're hoping to use some of the Sun Grant funds to actually get at those economic obstacles and provide more of a roadmap in terms of crops and technologies and how to bridge those things together. So,
Okay, well, you know, it's been a really quick recap of what's going on. There's more slides in your packet of some details, and we're convinced that Oregon can become a leader in sustainable energy. Wouldn't it be nice if we can grow our own energy, you know? It just really feels good. We export a lot of energy from this state right now. As you know, we have a lot of hydroelectric power that goes places, and it'd be nice if we had some biodiesel and ethanol so that we could be a bit more self-sustaining. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Well, thank you for coming and informing us today. I know it was short and sweet, but it was great information and a very exciting topic, I'm sure.
Okay, and like I said, after this session, if you'd like, we'd enjoy you seeing the biodiesel-powered car outside.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Sorry.
I
had listened to a presentation a while ago that even though we're moving into these type of biodiesels and energy sources, is that we still will not be able to get rid of our dependence on foreign countries, because we're importing a lot of these products also. In the States, do we have the capacity to meet a demand?
Well, in my opinion, okay, and raise it at that, it turns out that you can work out the mathematics, and you'll find that if you drive about 20,000 miles a year, you would need about 5 acres for the biodiesel for your vehicle if you got 40 miles per gallon. Okay, so the answer is probably we could cover a lot of what we need for our state. The neat and interesting thing about adding biodiesel and fuels like this to the system is that currently you're dealing with what I'd call an inelastic economic situation, where the supply and the demand are greatly adjusted by those that have control over the major sources of petroleum. If we introduce something which has 10 to 20% of the total energy needed for the process, we then have the ability to control that price and reduce their effective grasp on us. As we increase our ability and understanding of how to improve mileage, for example, I said 40 miles per gallon. Right now in Germany, you can buy a car that drives 100 miles per gallon. Okay, and we could accomplish it if we were willing to accept vehicles that got higher mileage and had less acceleration, if you wish, getting onto the freeway. So we have to change a little bit about how we deal with things, but we could be very much more self-sufficient, and in that way keep us from being behind the eight ball with other countries.
Thank you. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
I think at our demand level now, probably not. We would have to change our habits.
We have at our demand level and the way we use energy right now, we could not. Mm-hmm. But if we changed a bit, we certainly could.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming. Hopefully we'll
get
down and see your car.
Thanks.
Thank you to the students.
Oh, no, I'm not. Thanks.
We have one final person we've invited, Charles Carson from Cascade Green. And imagine him. He'll be easy.
The heavy clip here is being
that's
a
okay.
pain in the butt. So
thank you, too. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Let me get this started up here.
Okay. For the record, you need to state your name.
Yes, the name is Charles Carlson. I'm president of Cascade Grain Products. And, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today. I'd like to talk to you about ethanol. Cascade Grain, we're a 100 million gallon ethanol plant, and I was just going to go through that's going to be constructed here in Oregon, and I want to go through the slides to show you a little bit about the ethanol industry and what's going to happen here in Oregon. So let me go through these. Today's ethanol industry has come a long way since the early days. The newer technology in the last few years has increased efficiency on ethanol tremendously. The plants have become much better and much much better at what they do, and also very environmentally friendly. This is an example of a 49 gallon plant back in the Midwest. Newer plants are up to 100 million gallons in size, and just basically double that type of split structure that you show here. Cascade Grain will be built in Columbia County on the Columbia River. The plant design is state-of-the-art from grain receiving all the way through finished goods, and it'll be one of the first significant West Coast plants. Everybody asks, where are you on financing? Because it's been a difficult road. $50 crude oil has helped a lot. Anyway, we have our equity partners in place at this point in time, and they are currently reviewing term sheets from about three senior lending groups who want to lend the money to the senior debt on the project. I'm guessing in the next week or so they will select the senior lender that they wish to go for. That due diligence that the senior lenders will take roughly 60 to 90 days, so later this spring is where we'll be on starting construction out there. So at least we are getting to a point where we can say we're looking very closely at when we're going to be able to start construction. And what kind of state and community benefits will a plant like this give to Oregon? From a state level, of course, this plant will produce over 100 million gallons of local ethanol production, and that will equate to about 6% blend of all Oregon gasoline. We also create 320,000 tons of distiller dry grains, which is a high protein feed substance for primarily the livestock and dairy industry. This will displace product that is already shipped to the area. Land O'Lakes will be my marketer on the distiller dry grains, and they already ship into the Pacific Northwest over 300,000 tons of distiller dry grains. In addition, we will also have export potential. They are currently exporting to the Pacific Rim, but this plant will allow them to expand that base beyond what they're currently doing. So they're very excited about this plant being out in this area. Also, when you look at production of ethanol, you get the distiller dry grains, you get the ethanol, you also get carbon dioxide. We've worked with one of the major carbon dioxide providers, and they will be putting a carbon dioxide plant on the site, and that will produce 200,000 tons a year of carbon dioxide for the beverage and industrial unit uses. Of course, we talk about the local community benefits. Between the ethanol plant, which will employ about 50 people, the carbon dioxide plant does about another 30. We'll have 80 family wage jobs out there. During construction, which is about a 16-month period, we will have over 300 construction jobs, up to 300 construction jobs out there. People
can
out
you
there.
Give me an idea what the average wage will be? Because you say family wage. Do you have any idea?
With benefits, if I remember right, without looking on it, I think it was like $28 okay. was the average over all people at the plant. And that was including the benefit structure.
Thank you.
And over $125 million will be invested in the plant and equipment out there. And then, of course, as they were mentioning earlier from the OED, Oregon Economic Development, there's a great multiplier effect on those numbers. So it has a tremendous community benefit and a community that really needs it right now. But here's what happens when you take, and this will be a corn dry mill plant. And so one bushel of corn, here's what comes out of it. About 2.8 gallons of ethanol. On the newer plants, we're getting higher efficiencies of that. As we get better enzymes to extract more of the starch, we continue to improve that. This plant should be in somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.8 to 2.9. 2.84 is about the average. We get about 18 pounds of distiller dry grains, and that runs between 28 and 30% protein, and that's used in the dairy industry a lot. California is the biggest user of distiller dry grains in the country, but we have a vibrant dairy industry here between Oregon and Washington that is looking forward to a local secure supply of distiller dry grains. So you also have about 18 pounds of CO2 out of a bushel of corn. So roughly you get about a third ethanol, a third distiller dry grain, and a third carbon dioxide. And that's basically what your distiller dry grain looks like. That's really what's left of the corn after you take the starch out of it and dry it. Now, again, it's a high protein feed source, 27 to 30%, depending on a number of factors, how you run it through your plant, how you process it. You're getting a lot of export, especially out of the Gulf. There's been a lot of exports. You're heading to Europe. The Pacific Northwest market is growing leaps and bounds for exports into the Pacific Rim, where 5 years ago there was virtually no distiller dry grains going off the West Coast for export. Now we are shipping containerized loads, and we are getting interest from countries for bulk holds of distiller dry grains. Very effective, cost-effective protein additive. And then in the U.S., this last year, of an ethanol usage was roughly 3.4 billion gallons. Right now, there is 80 plants that are up and running. There's another 16 under construction. So this coming year, we should pass the 4 billion gallon mark on ethanol, or be very close to it. And the uses for ethanol, again, is not only just for oxygenate or cleaner fuels, smog reduction, but also as an extender and octane enhancer. Ethanol is 113 points of octane in it, so they use that to improve the octane in your gas from your subgrades to bring it up to mid-grade, unleaded grade or to a mid-grade. And also just a pure extender. In this year, there was times that ethanol was below crude oil price, and it was after you take into account the blender's credit. So a lot of the petroleum industry was using it just to extend the available sources that they had. Again, we know more of ethanol from the oxygenate for cleaner fuels, whether it be into the RFG, reformulated gas for smog or ozone, or the Portland winter oxygenate blend that's been going on here. So the current use of ethanol is basically the mandated markets, which is your RFG, your Minnesota's a mandated blend. So those kind of markets, that accounts for 70% of the market. There's a 30% of that is that all voluntary blending for octane and just extension. But in the total U.S. petroleum picture, it's a very small sliver. This year, like I said, 3.4 billion gallons of ethanol was produced, whereas we used 139 billion gallons of gasoline in the U.S. So we're taking only a very small percentage of that total petroleum industry. And ethanol has a lot of benefits. You have carbon monoxide reduction, decrease in carbon dioxide. You have your reductions in your VOCs, your other toxins. And under certain conditions, you can get a reduction in net emissions of greenhouse gases by as much as 37%. So it's very environmentally friendly. And it's a good, of course, we've seen it as a substitute MTBE, and we've heard some of the horror stories of MTBE, especially in groundwater contamination. And there's other things that ethanol is used for. It's, of course, growing in the transportation fuel market in the E10 and the E85 blends. On E85 right now, at the end of this year, there's be over 7 million cars on the road that can actually use E85. And those are some of the least polluting cars that are out there. At this point in time, not especially out in this area, you don't see E85 stations. You do see them back in the Midwest. And so you also have in fuel cell applications, and when I get to another slide here, I'll show you that the ethanol fuel cell is one of the least polluting CO2 greenhouse gases of any of the fuel cells out there. We also, especially back in the Midwest, and I'm Minnesota native, originally, you see a lot of ethanol and diesel blends for the coal fuel properties. If you go to the National Renewable Energy Lab, one of the best diesel blends that they come up with, especially when you look at coal flow and add that in there, is 80% diesel, 10% biodiesel, and 10% ethanol. especially in the colder climates, reduces the need for, number one, diesel to be blended in for to keep your diesel flowing. You also have your non-fuel markets, your beverage, and your industrial for solvents and chemical feedstocks. In world aspect, we're just a small part of the puzzle. Brazil is the leader in the ethanol production, and they're the leader in the percentage blended in their vehicles right now. It's mandated in Brazil 20 to 24% ethanol blends. In their fleet of vehicles, there's a lot of vehicles are full flex vehicles, either being 100% alcohol to 100% unleaded, and it's all controlled by the chip in the line where lodges switch back and forth, like our E85 vehicles do. But we are growing, and we expect the U.S. to match Brazil in the next couple of years. But we have a growing world market just because of the need for it. Where a lot of our need has come from is currently the banning of MTBE. Right now, MTBE is banned in 21 states, and many more are contemplating to ban this coming legislative session. I think I know of at least six of them here that are talking about additional MTBE bans. I was talking at the Well to Wheel Greenhouse Gas Program. This is GM. This is talking about grams of CO2 miles in fuel production in vehicles. And if you get over to the renewable side, and we're looking at the least CO2 grams per mile, you have the E85, which is the current cars that are out there, the 7 million I was talking about. But the most efficient as far as the least carbon dioxide per mile is the ethanol fuel cell. Of course, that goes up the chain up to conventional gasoline or even some of the fuel cell hybrids. And where is our current U.S. petroleum industry? According to the API, they released this information this week. In 2004, the refinery utilization was 92.8%. They're at 100% of max. They are not cannot cram anymore through their refineries at the current time. Crude oil imports, they rose 4% and now exceed 10 million barrels a day. On product import, now that's finished gas, finished diesel, they grew 10% to 2.86 million barrels a day. Over 10% of our finished gas is imported in a finished state that we don't even refine it here. Yeah, because we don't have that capacity, we bring it in. Gasoline deliveries, in other words, what our volume that we use this year was up 1.3% nationwide. The 10-year average is a 1.8% increase every year. And this year, this last year, we used approximately 139 million billion gallons of gasoline nationwide. On distillate deliveries, that would be your diesels, high sulfur, low sulfur. They were up 3.5%. There is a when you break out these numbers, actually, low sulfur diesel was up 6.8%. High sulfur diesel and heating oil were actually down a little bit. So your on-road diesel is coming up quite a bit. Domestic crude production between Alaska and the lower 48 actually fell 3.8. We're running out of that crude to 5.47 million barrels a day. And you see we're already exceeding 10 million being brought in. And you will hear, as you always seems to hear, that we don't want mandates. Petroleum industry, in some of the conversations I hear, they'll say they don't want mandates. And they would rather not have ethanol mandated to them, but they live currently with many mandates, as everybody does throughout the industry and are all throughout our life. Right now, they're mandated to use unleaded gas. We mandated that the lead was taken out of gas. They're reformulated gas for smog reduction. We also have oxygenated fuel requirements for carbon monoxide reduction. Most of these came out of the clean air laws that have been enacted. And even in those Clean Air Acts, we also have smoking bans. We have emission limits in both for our auto and regular industry. And we have our clean water requirements that are mandated to us for discharge limits, for stormwater requirements. So the truth is we have mandates throughout. As far as ethanol volume potential through the U.S., at 139 billion gallons that we use of gasoline, if that was 10%, you're basically looking at about a 14 billion gallon market for potential. And can ethanol from corn provide all that? No, we can't. Experts will estimate that we could take from the corn industry or from agriculture production about 9 to 11 billion gallons. We have to get to cellulosic ethanol. And at that point in time, you open it up for landfill, straw, all wood waste products, and that's eventually the place where we can grow this industry so that hopefully we could get to a place like Brazil is right now with 20 to 24% blends. And I think that's the future that would come out here, that combination of ethanol from grain and ethanol from cellulose. That's my... Any questions?
Any questions? Representative Sumner.
Chair Smith, sir, perhaps I wasn't listening close enough. I didn't hear precisely the location of the proposed ethanol plant.
It's at Port Westward in Columbia County, which is right next to Clatskanie, about 10 miles out.
Thank you.
Yeah, on the Columbia River in Oregon. Yes?
Representative Robles.
Chair. Is the cellulose technology just not as advanced as the grain technology right now?
Right. You can look at the cellulose technology roughly where the corn technology from grain was 20 years ago. It's coming along. You know, the people have said through the years, in another 5 years, we'll be there with cellulose technology. They've been saying that for 20 years. In reality, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're seeing some major advances that we're going to start. We're see cellulose become viable. At this current time, it's about a $3 a gallon cost factor in cellulose versus ethanol from grain being just slightly over a dollar.
Well, you're using corn in this particular plant. Are there others that produce more, or is corn the most effective for your ethanol?
Corn right now is used in over 95% of the ethanol plant because of its ability, because the monostarch has the cost, the product, and the ability to convert it. So it's the highest conversion of all the grains. White wheat is actually has some of the highest starch, which is a potential out there. But it's still in between the cost of the initial cost of the product and the conversion, is it's not up to the profitability or the availability of corn.
And one last one. Corn production, are we getting to that point where we're maxing that right now, or do you see more growth available for ethanol?
You are going to see growth from both production of seeds for that specifically look for higher starch corns. If you look back in history, you know, this year, last year, we planted slightly over 80 million acres of corn. Back in the early 1900s, 1917, I believe, was over 100 million acres of corn was planted in the country. So we are increasing yields, and we can increase acreage, but there is that limit. You know, what this plant does is basically, off the Pacific Northwest, about 25% of the U.S. exports of corn are shipped, and we're just tapping about 10% of that market to add value to the corn rather than to export it.
Rotational crop with corn?
Back in the Midwest, a lot of times it's corn on corn.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. And it's getting more of that. I know there's some, I think it was Iowa, has had a plot in production for over 100 years of corn on corn.
Any other questions?
No other question. Thank you for inviting me to testify today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for providing us with the information. I'm sure we'll be in touch.
You'll hear more from me. Yeah.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else? No. Okay. I'm going to close the informational meeting. Thank you very much, committee, and for those who participated. Interesting issue, and I'm sure we'll be pursuing this as well. So, with that, we are adjourned.